Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As John McCain's top economic advisor, Douglas Holtz Aiken was right in the middle of the 2008 presidential campaign. Then voters had their say. John McCain went back to Capitol Hill. His top economist did not go to the White House. But he's still watching, critiquing the Obama administration and his own party, the GOP. This hour, On Point, a view from the right with Douglas Holtz Aiken. You can join the conversation. Are you with Holtz Aiken in worrying about the soaring deficit, a bigger government hand in health care? Do you wish Obama listened more or less to complaints from the GOP? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Douglas Holtz Aiken. He was director of the Congressional Budget Office from 2003 to 2005, won open respect from initially skeptical Democrats in that role. He served in top roles at the Council of Economic Advisers for Presidents George W. and George H.W. Bush. He was chief economic advisor to the McCain-Palin 2000 campaign last year. Now he's working to start a new GOP think tank in Washington. Douglas Holtz Aiken, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's great to have you with us. If you'll indulge us, let's listen for just a second to kick off to your former candidate, John McCain, Senator McCain. He was on Face the Nation yesterday and responded to a question about how President Obama is doing. Let's listen.
I think he's done well. I think he has been, if you want to look at a legislative scorecard, he has achieved literally every one of his legislative accomplishments. Unfortunately, it's by picking off a couple of Republicans. It's not been bipartisan. So there really hasn't been that change in the climate in Washington. But, that elections have consequences. On the issue of national security, I think the president is facing a major challenge here, North Korea and others, and so it's sort of an incomplete.
John McCain, yesterday on Face the Nation. Douglas Holtz Aiken, there's your former candidate. He says, I think he's done well. Is he off message, or do you two disagree? There's his big umbrella statement. What do you say?
Well, I think, number one, it's typical John McCain to be courteous and respectful of those even with whom he disagrees on the policies. And my suspicion is, and I can't speak for John, that if you went through point by point, he might have less complete agreement with some of the things the Obama administration has done, whether it be the takeover of the auto companies, the very large deficits that they've baked into their budgets. There are some concerns on the substance, but I think his sentiments are ones that we should all share, which is that it would be a good thing for the president of the United States to do well and for this country to prosper.
I wish you'd just sort of, I guess it's a game at this point, but it's an interesting one to look at. I mean, we've all seen the challenges that President Obama inherited. It could have been Senator McCain. It wasn't. It was Obama. And now he's stepped in to address those. If it had been President McCain, given what we know about all the things that were blowing up as the Bush administration went out the door, how do you think policy in addressing just the economic crisis, first of all, Douglas Holtz, might have been different under a McCain administration in these last, 6-8 months now?
Well, one will never know. Let's just be honest about that at the outset. And I'll be honest enough to say that I've wondered this on occasion. Mm-hmm. But if the McCain campaign had the chance to govern, it certainly would have taken a different approach in several areas. I think on the stimulus bill, over $800 billion with relatively low bang for the buck, there would have been a very different strategy, something genuinely more temporary, something genuinely more targeted on homeowners and on families, and something which tried to use as much as possible the tradition of the automatic stabilizers that get bigger when the economy worsens, things like unemployment insurance and the like, but then automatically contract when the economy gets better so that we would not have a budget situation which sees us, quite frankly, in very perilous straits. I think one of the great differences between John McCain and this administration is his tradition of being genuinely a fiscal conservative and If you take the Obama budget at face value as the congressional budget priced it, it says that we will run deficits that never really get below 4% of our gross domestic product, which is well above the safety line. They will be growing over the next 10 years. And by the end of 10 years, we will have doubled the debt and in the hands of the public relative to the size of our economy. It will be 82% instead of 40 at the start. It will be rising, and we will be borrowing essentially for the purpose of paying off the interest on that debt. And that's a very unsafe path for the United States, and one that John McCain would not have taken.
We'll talk about how we got on that deficit path. Of course, even during the last weeks of the Bush administration, a lot of money was being poured at a crisis that many people was going to go into economic freefall. You said that John McCain might have let those banks just go down, might have let the U.S. automakers just go into regular old bankruptcy, no government handholding. Of course, there was already handholding under George Bush, but what about on those two fronts in particular?
I think it would have been a different strategy. The automakers clearly are now going through a bankruptcy process. We're seeing GM strip out divisions, lose product lines. We're closing factories in Ohio and Michigan. And the question is, what did we get for the $50 billion that we'll put into that company? That is what a regular bankruptcy process would do. It is painful, but it is designed to ensure that the company moves forward with as productive and optimistic a future as it can have. And so one does have to wonder what this process bought us, given that we're getting all the pain and we have now the taxpayers owning GM and the same kind of a situation at Chrysler. On the issue of the financial institutions, you know, what Senator McCain has always really thought and what I think is the right thing to do is to turn this less into stabilizing particular banks and instead make the focus on stabilizing particular functions in the economy. I mean, it's important for people to be able to put their money in and get it out and have checking accounts be safe. It's important to get loans. It's important to have those financial functions. It's not real important to have the particular banks with the particular labels that we have. And it strikes me as slightly incredulous that we would be this far into a financial crisis and still see the same management and the same shareholders at the same banks with no real market discipline. And so a tougher line on that front, I think, is appropriate.
Do you think John McCain could have, would have, actually let AIG, Bank of America, Citibank, go down, go bankrupt, go out of business, those nameplates and their management just go away? Could he have really done that?
Whether as a matter of getting legislation, and there would have to have been some legislation to go through the Congress to give the wind-down authority for those large institutions, authorities which the Obama administration is now requesting in its financial regulatory overhaul, whether that would have happened on the timetable, I don't know. It would have been the right thing to do. The key is to recognize these institutions are a threat, to take them over and wind them down as quickly as possible, and thereby cut off the collateral damage to the rest of the economy, make sure that you don't get the systemic fallout, and then sell off their assets to new entities who run them in a better fashion. And you know, we know now that if you look at something like Citigroup, which has gotten in trouble in every way you can over the past decade and a half, the emerging market crises, housing crises, you name it, they've had that problem. They're probably too big to manage and probably need to be downsized.
And so they might have just gone. But, of course, those bailouts began under George Bush and Hank Paulson for both the auto industry and the banks. Was that a mistake last fall?
The original formulation of the auto loans was quite dramatic. It was using the monies which were in the TARP, which was targeted for financial institutions, to give short-term loans to the automakers. And there was a rationale, which in the moment I can defend, which is if credit markets have frozen to the point where these companies can't maintain their normal financing and the customers can't get their normal auto loans, then there's an appropriate step to deal with the financial market crisis and its fallout. And there were many industries in that position. That's very different than bailing out the auto companies, taking ownership stakes, and deciding who will run them and what their product lines will look like. We have really moved a long, long way from the original rationale, and there was a place to stop a while back.
But the message we sort of heard out of those months, and certainly more recently from Obama, was that we can't let these go. They are too big. They're too important now, too important to the future. And on the economic front, that we need a stimulus and a big stimulus right now to avoid a systemic collapse. Did you not take that threat seriously? Would, if you were sitting in the White House advising John McCain, would you not be concerned that, you know, we could have the, what, don't drown it in dollars and it gets even much worse scenario on our hands?
Well, let's remember that an awful lot of that $800 billion is not going to show up this year or next year. It's money that's going to show up in 2011, 12, 13, when even by the administration's own estimates, the economy will have fully recovered. And then their projections, unemployment will be back down near 5%. So the genuine need for stimulus will be long gone. And that, I think, reveals the problem with the bill, which is it's not really a stimulus bill. It's a big spending bill, which bakes in the cake some policies that lead us down a path of debt. So was the economy in trouble? Absolutely. Were there things that were necessary to be done in the financial markets? Yes. Were there things that were done in stimulus? Sure. But a one-year payroll tax holiday would have pumped far more money into the economy far quicker than anything the stimulus bill did and would have had a dramatic impact.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with John McCain's chief economic advisor in the 2008 campaign about how Obama and the GOP are doing in 2009. Douglas Holtz-Aiken joins us from Washington. He was right there in the heart of the McCain-Palin campaign last year. He's former director of the Congressional Budget Office from 2003 to 2005. A lot of Democrats were worried about him coming into that position. When he went out, he went out with quite a few compliments from Democrats, but he's very critical right now of the Obama administration. What about on the health care front? That's as big as it gets in dollar terms, Douglas Holtz-Aiken. What do you make of what President Obama and the Democrats are rolling out?
Well, I mean, one can hope that we really do get a bipartisan deal this year. There is no area where I think there's clear need for broad reforms than in the health care area. We have a system which costs too much, we get too little for our money, and we cover too few Americans. And this is where one would have hoped the past partisan traditions could have been discarded and we could have seen bills that really reflected input from both sides so that we got a bipartisan bill. And I think that's important for two reasons. I mean, number one, it would be a genuine consensus bill and bring the ideas of both sides together. But number two, it's far more likely to be a durable reform. And we need something that which is lasting and changes the trajectory of things in the United States. So I remain hopeful of that. Certainly there are those on both sides of the aisle who see this as the best path forward. And it's early in the legislative process. So even though I wouldn't embrace everything on every piece of paper that has come out, most of these are incomplete. The work's still being done, and I remain hopeful.
You've been very critical of an increased government hand in health care, though polls out over the weekend, you know, we're seeing here say a lot of Americans at this point say they would welcome it. And when we look at the mess we've got now in health care, private health insurance seems to have a very substantial part of the responsibility for it. You're more market-oriented in your solutions, but why should the country trust that, given where we've come with private health care so far?
Well, I think the key is to recognize we have lots of bad health insurance markets. We have 50 different state insurance markets. Not all of them are characterized by the kinds of things you'd like to see, which is many companies competing for your business, treating you decently and serving you well, and competing on the grounds of quality and price. That's far from a reality in the United States. But the notion that we can solve this problem with the public option, I think, really misses the point. If you think about what the public options do, one variation is to simply have a big insurance company that pays all the doctors and hospitals Medicare rates plus 5 or 10%, depending on how it's put together. What that would do is, number one, raise the question, what happens to prescription drugs? Because there is no regular benefit prescription drugs. There's the Part D program. So they'd have to work out that technical detail. But also, it would spread Medicare-like problems all through the healthcare industry in the United States, into every hospital and doctor for non-Medicare patients. And Medicare is on its route to bankruptcy. It is a program where increasingly people find difficulty getting doctors to accept Medicare patients. And it was, in my experience at the Congressional Budget Office, one of the saddest things to watch, which is the political interference and the absence of really good medicine being delivered at a reasonable cost to Medicare. Medicare is a system designed to make sure that hospitals get their money, that doctors get their money, that insurance companies get their money, and that drug companies get their money. But it is not a system that's designed to coordinate care around our seniors, deliver an integrated product of high quality at low cost. And to go that route with a public option is, in my case, in my view, to make the problem worse, not better.
But has the private health market been more effective at that kind of collaborative vision that you're hinting at there?
No. This is the need for reform. There's no question. And the question is, can we set up the incentives to pay doctors instead of for every little piece of a hospital visit? So, for example, I am the lucky recipient of a kidney procedure where I was both the donor and recipient of my own kidney. I had a problem with my renal artery. Mm-hmm. So the way we pay is we pay people for the screens before I go in, the pre-op, the operation, the post-operative recovery, discharge, checkups, piece by piece by piece. But no one pays anyone to make sure that there's a high-quality operation with a high-quality outcome. And we can get there. That would be a tremendous improvement in our healthcare system. And that's not a partisan issue. That's something that both sides recognize and I hope becomes a foundation of this reform.
Douglas Holtz Aiken is with us. He was top economic advisor to John McCain in the campaign last year. Let's turn to our callers. Kendra in Lake City, South Carolina. Kendra, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Kendra. You're on.
Hi. I just want to say that I have heard a lot of conservatives, you know, talk about, you know, us running up the deficit and everything like that. But I just wonder if you can say specifically what could be done to boost the economy other than, you know, shoveling out more money to create projects and to, you know, to get things moving again.
He said earlier a tax cut, a payroll tax cut for 1 year. How does that sound to you, Kendra?
Well, no, I think they've been talking about that a really long time, and I really don't think that helps very much when you're talking about even long-term economic success. I think the best way to go is what they were talking about with education. You get more educated people gaining more skills who are able to contribute more to the society to increase the economic output over the long haul.
Kendra, let us hold that, and we'll definitely come to it. I've got one more caller on that front in New Haven, Connecticut. Iris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have a couple of comments. Number one, my first comment I want to make is that I believe health care is a fundamental human right. And for a country as wealthy as the United States, it's really shameful that so many people are uninsured. That's number one. Number two is I'm not so concerned about the deficit. My concern is job creation. I have been collecting unemployment close to a year. My husband as well. We're both college educated, highly marketable skills, and we're unable to find work. Not to mention now my mortgage is falling behind. What is your answer to that? That's my concern, is creating jobs. I think that in the coming year or two, there are going to be much more problems with much more unemployed people that are not being recorded because they're falling through the tracks because they've stopped collecting unemployment benefits.
Maybe stop looking. Iris, thanks for that. Let's pick them up. Douglas Holtz Aiken, there's Iris. She says, you know, where she sits, job creation is more important than the deficit issue. You heard Kendra there saying, okay, you don't want to do stimulus spending. What would you do, sir?
So I want to make sure that everyone is clear that the need for short-run stimulus, which will involve spending more, taxing less, is clear. And I don't think there's a big dispute about that. The question is, what does one do past that in terms of a strategy to meet national objectives? And I believe Kendra's got it exactly right on education. Meet those national objectives while not leaving behind to our children the threat of a debt burden so large that either international lenders cut us off or they simply are unable to meet their other needs in paying off our legacy. So what you'd like to see is the short-run stimulus, and we can have the debate about the best way to do that. But the real key is, past the first year and a half, what kind of trade-offs? Are you going to be honest to the American people and say, yes, we need a better education system, but that means we have to do less of something else? And I think there are lots of places where we could change the way we do business in education, in Social Security, in healthcare, in the environment, meet the goals that I think both parties share, but do it in a way that is not so costly and so threatening to our children. We are rapidly approaching the kind of situation where you worry about the stability of the currency on international markets, and that's the concern. Job creation is a big deal, and traditionally in the United States, the way we recover from recessions is that small firms, primarily, but some large ones, but largely the small firms look around the landscape and they say, "Boy, you know, this is a bargain hunting time for new facilities. This is a bargain hunting time to hire skilled workers. Let's go grab these guys, put together new products, and get going." And that's usually been the engine for recovery. My concern would be that we somehow not give them the freedom to fulfill their traditional role, and then we don't see the job creation. We didn't do very well in the last recession. That was a quote, jobless recovery. I think there are fair concerns about the pace of job creation right now. Unemployment continues to rise, and my best guess is it will rise even further. So we ought to do everything we can to keep the burden off the small businesses so that they can go do their job.
You're an economist with a lot of technical training, but you've got personal history as well. I was reading you grew up near Pittsburgh. I think your father was manager in a steel plant there. And in the 80s, he oversaw the closing of that plant. And you've been quoted as describing that as the most horrific thing I've ever seen, quoting you. What did you see, and what did you learn from it? Talk about job loss.
My father loved the steel industry, and I loved it right along with him from having watched him. And to come out of college as a Navy ROTC graduate, go to work in the mills as a management trainee, work his way through the ladder to the point where he ultimately ran some mills in Pittsburgh, and then where his final job was to fire those he'd worked with all those years and then literally cut the mills apart with cutting torches and sell off the scrap. I've never seen a man suffer so much. It was awful. And so no one should ever pretend that these are easy times and that there are quick solutions to our economic problems. And the kinds of labor market adjustments that we often see are just unbelievable. That should always remind economists, for whom much of this becomes, you know, dry numbers and an empty theory, that there are people out there, and there really is a lot of pain right now, and it places a premium on having the most effective solutions. And I think that's the top priority.
Let's go to Andy in Needham, Massachusetts. Hi, Andy. You're on the air with Douglas Holtaken.
Hi, yes. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. I'm referring back to the comment that was made that McCain would have had his stimulus package come off of reducing payroll taxes, which is great, except that as our unemployment goes up, that reduces the amount of help it is. I'll be laid off effective next Tuesday, so it wouldn't help me anymore.
Because you won't be paying payroll taxes anyway.
Right, so it's not going to help me. Mm-hmm. And then, in fact, that it is sort of a double whammy in my case because I'm being laid off. I work in human services. Mm-hmm. The state of Massachusetts is cutting human services left and right to very needy people with serious mental health and mental illness issues. And because of the reduction in those services to people is the reason that I'm being laid off. So it just seems to me that the payroll tax is his answer is not an answer.
Douglas Holtaken, what do you say to Andy? You hear she's staring straight at it.
Sure. Let me be clear. I mean, that's me talking, not John McCain. John McCain actually did have an alternative stimulus bill that he and several Republicans offered in the Senate. It did focus more on tax cuts, but it had components of spending as well. And I think the right package is one-part payroll tax, because that targets both the largest tax for the majority of Americans. It's a bigger tax than the income tax for most Americans. It targets the labor market, where you have so many problems. It makes it cheaper to keep employees on, makes it cheaper to hire an employer, puts money in the pockets of those who are working. But it's not an exclusive remedy. There are no magic bullets in any recession, and I would have liked to have seen very robust increases in the things I referred to earlier, the, quote, automatic stabilizers, food stamps, the welfare benefits, the unemployment insurance, the traditional means by which we keep people having the ability to meet their needs during a recession, and unlike some of the programs we did enact, which would scale back as people left those roles and went back into a job.
Andy, thanks for your call. Let's get a call from Michael in Beaufort, North Carolina.
Hello?
Hello, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi. Your guest, besides besides these specific policy differences that I have, I just have to ask, when he talks about McCain would have done this and that, we have a president who is hands-on now, and things seem to be stabilizing. There's no silver bullet, and I'm still very concerned and watching with great concern what comes out of Washington. But I have a faith that Obama has hands-on, and that when he sits down and deliberates, he's actually involved in very difficult decisions. When your guest keeps referring to what McCain would have done, all I can remember is McCain's coming to Washington at the height of the crises
last fall,
and saying that he was going to be involved and make and he needed to be there as an emergency, and he did nothing but grandstand photo ops. So what exactly does he mean by what McCain would have done, when McCain seems to have no clue about the economy when tasked directly with it? And we might have had Palin as a VP. I don't understand what this looking back is all about.
Michael, thanks for the call. Douglas Holtz-Aiken, how about it? The country was watching your candidate very closely last year, and that was quite a controversial pass there where everything seemed to be on the line, and he rushed to Washington. How do you look back on that?
Well, I mean, I first want to make clear to all the listeners that I'm talking, Doug Holtz-Aiken, not John McCain, and speculation about what McCain would have done is strictly mine. We'll never know. In terms of the episode in the campaign, this was a period where Senator McCain had received briefings from top economic leaders and financial market leaders. He was in New York City. They described the situation, which was just frightening and apocalyptic. I mean, I had never heard such language coming out of the financial markets. He was deeply concerned. At the same time, he looked back to Washington and saw a process that was broken. There was no way to get what ultimately became the TARP bill through the Congress. The House was in particular deadlocked, where Nancy Pelosi had insisted that Republicans deliver votes, and they were not willing to. And he felt that situation was unacceptable, that what should happen is that the campaigns should get together and agree that with the then-President Bush, Senator Obama's and Senator McCain should take steps to break the logjam in Washington. And he went back dedicated to doing that. I think it reflects his best instincts as a problem solver in the U.S. Senate. And what people, I think, forget quickly is it worked. It wasn't smooth and easy, as much of legislation isn't, but it was a situation where the Republicans in the House, at his urging, agreed to negotiate. They sat at the table, Republicans, Democrats, senators, congressmen, and they ultimately hammered out a bill that passed the Congress and gave then-Secretary Paulson authority to intervene in the financial market. So history may judge him and did judge him in the electoral sense, but in terms of the substance of what he wanted to accomplish, it was about getting needed relief into financial markets.
We're up against a break here in just half a minute, but was John McCain's task just impossible, given the economy he was inheriting out of the George W. Bush years? Could any Republican president have won? How do you look at that these months later?
I am told by seasoned observers of politics that it really was just too hard a task, and that what one should remember is his accomplishments in getting the nomination earlier than any Republican ever had, in polling extremely well in extremely difficult circumstances, and the truth is, you have to look forward. It's part of the past. It was an extraordinary ride and a great experience, but my primary concern now is about the future and what happens next.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with John McCain's chief economic advisor in the 08 campaign about how Obama and the GOP are doing in 2009. Douglas Holtz-Aiken, you've talked about a Republican Party that you said what's not happening is the start of a rethinking the basic ideas of the party. You've said the party needs to do that. You're working on putting together a new think tank that might encourage that. I want to play something for you here from this is former Vice President Dick Cheney talking last month with Bob Schieffer of CBS, saying essentially the GOP Republicans, are what they are, and there's a lot that shouldn't be changed.
I don't think the party ought to move dramatically to the left, for example, in order to try to redefine its base. We are what we are. We're Republicans. We have certain things we believe in, and maintaining our loyalty and commitment to those principles is vital to our success.
We are what we are, said the vice president. There are some in the party who are almost saying we are who we are, though that has been a shrinking population in recent months and years. What about the "we are what we are" argument, Douglas Holtzhagen?
Well, I think if you look at the results of the 2008 cycle, where Republican electorate was very concentrated in the South, where we didn't win in the cities, we didn't win among any of the minority groups, we lost the youth vote for the third straight election, we polled poorly across many of the education classes. I mean, regardless of how you break the electorate, the Republican Party looks too narrow to compete broadly and nationally. And it does not strike me as an objectionable thing to run in every district in the United States the most conservative Republican who can win. And that person will look very different in Maine and in New York and in California than they might in a Texas or an Arizona, for that matter. So the key is to move the party toward the ideas. Ideas once animated the party. Some of those ideas, I think the vice president correctly pointed out, have not changed. Strong commitment to national defense, deep belief in a government that seeks the roles it's suited to and not others, fiscal discipline, and but there are some things where I think we can engage on the bread and butter issues that people are concerned about. I mean, people do care about education, they care about health care, they care about the environment, and one of the things that Republicans need to deliver is both the message that they are in touch with the issues people care about and that they can do something for the middle class. They can restore to them the traditional American dream of getting ahead during their lifetime and leaving a legacy of a better economy for their children than the one they inherited. Those are things that we really have to do better on. And in doing so, it'd be nice to have fewer litmus tests. Let's welcome people, welcome their ideas, and have a vigorous debate about the way forward.
You used an interesting phrase there, saying Republicans should field the most conservative candidate who can win. That suggests to my ear that if that's fairly middle of the road, center, or even left by Dick Cheney's measure, all right by you, as long as they can win? I mean, I've got a comment from online here. Joe saying the GOP must disown the Bush years and go back to being the party of low taxes, economic growth, defending nation's borders, and fiscal responsibility. Is the most conservative who can win a kind of Bush years two formula?
Well, I think one of the keys for the party and for people like myself, sort of center right conservatives who care about this country, is to turn this back into a debate about the ideas and about the policies. There is nothing about the current debate that should be about personalities. This isn't about a George W. Bush. Quite frankly, it's not about a Barack Obama. It's about the policies that were pursued, are pursued, what is successful, what meets the needs of the nation, and how can we construct the policies that are consistent with our principles and are effective in helping people? You know, we share the goal of making the United States a better place. Let's argue on the merits how to do that.
You said there are ideas and issues that the GOP hasn't really wanted to engage with. Which? And what ought to be doing there now?
Well, I think if you ask, as I have, I've asked a lot of people about how they viewed the election. One of the things that came through was, well, all Republicans believe in is tax cuts. And that's a caricature of the real beliefs of the party, where the commitment is to the liberties, both political and economic, that the United States stands for, the ability to allow entrepreneurs to start businesses, giving them a climate of regulation and other aspects, including taxes, that support that and as a route to prosperity for everyone. But the reality is people say, oh, it's just tax cuts. So we need to retool and rethink how we convey our principled belief in individual liberties as a route to prosperity for most Americans and get it away from just tax cuts solve all problems.
But how does that work when you've got issues that may require some kind of concerted public effort to solve?
The goal is not to say that we should go to a world where government's always the problem. I think that era has passed. Government has a role to play in healthcare. The reform of state insurance markets is properly a role of state governments, and many of them have failing governments. And for me, an excellent approach to healthcare reform would be to put the states in the driver's seat. We've seen Massachusetts, very blue state, Utah, very red state, both have bipartisan healthcare reforms in recent years. We could ask every state to engage in that. We can provide some federal support, but ask them to make the commitment to provide low-income subsidies, to deal with high-cost patients, and to fix their insurance regulations so that we have insurers competing on the right grounds. What's the best price? What's the best product? Not who can I keep out of my pool? So there are ways to do this, very different than what we're here in Washington, that are consistent with having the government play a role, but also having the private sector pick up its piece as well.
Let's take a call from Ray in Boston. Hi, Ray. You're on the air with Douglas Holtz-Aiken.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would say the key to the Republicans is to stay conservative. And Reagan showed that staying conservative can win. And I would say that the big element for the Republican Party to win is just two words, and that's Sarah Palin. Anything you say, she's a superstar. And that's why the Democrats go after her so strong. She's the biggest threat. And barring some unforeseen circumstance, it seems like she's the one that's going to ride all the way to the nomination. And I think she's really the anti-Obama. She could win. And Sarah Palin's the key.
Ray, we've got it. And that's very interesting for our guest. How about it? Sarah Palin, you were on the inside of the McCain-Palin campaign. Douglas Holtz-Aiken, do you see her as a superstar, the ticket to the GOP future?
Lots of people want to pick the person and play essentially the personality politics. Some say it's Mitt Romney. You'll hear those talking about Governor Pawlenty in Minnesota, Governor Daniels in Indiana, you know, Governor Bush from Florida. There are many people perceived to be the future of the party. And right now, quite frankly, no one is the absolute leader of the party. No one speaks for Republicans as a whole. And I think that's actually appropriate at this point in the cycle. It has been a difficult year. We're moving into midterm elections and then ultimately the 2012 race. And we will see which of those candidates, which animate some people, are able to grab the ideas, articulate them, and become a clear spokesman for the party. And I think that's a process that I certainly would like to foster and which would be a healthy one for the party and for the nation.
You know, that's a kind of a dry answer to a question that had a lot of sort of gusto in it. I mean, here's a apparently Republican caller saying this is the – you may not like it to be personality politics, but it makes a big difference, as you know. He says Governor Palin's got the stuff to rally conservatives. That's what the GOP needs. He calls her a superstar. You were in the campaign with her. Do you see her as a superstar? Do you see her as one who might lead to the future you hope for the GOP?
She is one who might, but I don't think she is at this point cemented stature that would suggest that she speaks for all Republicans. I don't think she's cemented a stature that suggests she's the clear choice for the future for the Republican Party. And you know, I have an enormous respect for the governor, and she's a fabulous politician. Put a microphone in her hand in front of a crowd, it's quite an experience. It's 4 years to the next election, and it's a long time. There's a lot of work to be done across the spectrum, and the question is, you know, will she or someone else step up and display the breadth of command of issues and ideas that generates what I think of as not just the political personality in the moment, but the ability to pull together a broad coalition and lead a party.
You were in a campaign where she was the right in the heart of it. Do you think she shares your vision of what the GOP needs to do? Our caller says stay conservative. Your message seems to be more flexible than that.
I can't speak for the governor, but I can say that, you know, there's an instinctive way of saying things among some Republicans, which is, you know, we just got to go back to Reagan. And I think it's important to remember that it's a very different time than when Ronald Reagan became president. Marginal tax rates are not 70%. Inflation's not double digits. At that time, we were wondering if the United States was going to continue to be a superpower. There had been no productivity growth in the United States for quite some time, and the system appeared to be broken, and social conservatives felt they had no voice on the national stage. We're now in a world that's very different, and I believe that we should not go back to the playbook that Ronald Reagan ran, but rather the principles that have always governed Republicans and display them in this environment for this country and the population that lives here now. And I think that'll be very successful.
It's notable that you're setting out to build a new think tank for the GOP to look forward when there are famously very big and very well endowed think, Republican, conservative think tanks, already quite vigorously evident in Washington, the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute. Is the fact that you feel the need to start a new one an indicator that the GOP is not lined, or at least that the money that supports the think tanks is not lined up with your thinking?
Well, I mean, number one, it keeps me out of trouble, and that's a good thing, so I can go do this. But those are great allies, and I always, you know, I have been a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. I was a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. They have tremendous stature, but there's another niche, something that we can add, which is one which is open and embracing to center-right conservatives, whether they be Republican, Democrat, or Independent, which is committed to the idea that you can come and express those ideas and expect to get a fair hearing of them on the principles, even if people might disagree with you, and which has, in my view, fewer litmus tests about what can and cannot be discussed, what is and is not good policy, but instead is more interested in the quality of the debate and the ideas that people can bring to it. As I talk to people around the country, they love to have that fight. The Republican Party is an intellectually driven party. Conservatives are very much ideas animated, but that conversation seems to have gotten pushed aside in recent years, and we want to just restore the vigor and find a place where we can put it.
Can you give us just a couple quick examples of litmus test issues that have been out of bounds that you'd like to put on the table for GOP conversation?
Well, suppose that we had a Social Security reform that embraced President Obama's proposal that we raise the payroll tax in 2017 when cash flow deficits show up, and we paired that with a complete rethinking of what the entitlement is. The entitlement at the moment is one that says, well, if you get old and you don't have much in the way of skills or money, we're going to give you support. Let's rework that entitlement to say, let's make sure every American gets the college education so that they don't arrive at old age with no skills and with more money, and build a different kind of Social Security reform, embracing the notion that as part of getting the deal done, you might have to place some near-term pressure on the payroll tax. You ought to be able to talk about that, but in many cases, that would be vetoed outright as not a sensible reform, even though it makes a lot of sense in the big picture.
Vetoed because? On the GOP side, because of the tax issue, because of an increase. Angelo in Hamden, Connecticut, you're on the air with Douglas Holtzakin.
Hi, Tom. Just wanted to talk to you about the American middle class. Over the past 40 years, the American middle class has not benefited from the American economy. Median household income has only increased by 30% since 1967. The other issue is international trade. As a result of international trade, we've lost a lot of middle class jobs. If you let the steel industry go down, the automobile industry go down, a lot of good jobs will be lost. What does Douglas Holtzakin propose to do to counterbalance the negative consequences of free trade?
Angelo, thanks very much. Douglas?
Well, I think we need to equip ourselves to compete on the global scale instead of hiding. The reality
these
is
were
that
the years,
out of this
these
recession,
were the years of globalization and a lot of Republican White Houses. And we all know what happened to those median incomes.
But a lot of those median incomes were chewed up by rising health care costs. We've discussed that. I think it needs to be taken care of. A lot of the people coming into the labor force were not well suited to take advantage of it because of the failure of our education system. That's unmistakable, and that has to be a piece of this. But it also has to be the case that we recognize coming out of this recession, households are burdened by an enormous amount of debt and housing values that are down. We're going to have to stop being the last retail market on the planet. We've been that for a decade and a half. We're going to have to sell more abroad. We're going to have businesses carry some of the spending in the economy. That means putting together policies that build a vigorous manufacturing ability to make things here and sell abroad. We don't have tax policies that are doing that right now. We don't allow firms to expense their investments. We don't have the sort of regulatory policies that allow us to compete internationally. And we don't really make an effort. We need to embrace the idea that we need to sell to the 95% of the world's customers that are outside our borders. That is our future. And think about everything through the lens of our ability to compete on the global stage.
We've just got a minute here. You've talked a lot about deficits and warned of the price that the country may pay for them. On the other hand, they grew a lot during George W. Bush's administration. Ben Bernanke has said this month, you know, hey, we're going to have to, you know, at some point here pretty soon start to get control of these. President Obama has said the same thing. Americans may be confused given George W. Bush's record, and you know which way to look. Why should they turn to the Republican Party for deficit control?
They should turn to action. You know, quite frankly, we've had two presidents recently who've done the same thing. They both campaigned on a tax cut. George Bush did. So did President Obama. They committed to that tax cut and went through with it despite the profligate spending ways of their colleagues in Congress. That was true for the Republicans. It's now true for the Democrats. They both explained it in the same way. We have a national crisis and a big recession. Deficits are okay. Don't worry about it. I'll cut it in half at the end of 4 years. That's identical, both of them. It's all talk, and we need real action on this front. And the person who delivers the action is the one I'm interested in supporting.
That sounds like a pretty open-minded position. It's interesting to hear. I hope we can have you back and hear how your view develops as this term goes on. Thanks very much for being with us today, Douglas Holtz-Aiken. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Former chief policy advisor to the presidential campaign of Republican Senator John McCain, Douglas Holtz-Aiken. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.